You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for a special one-hour edition of Jonesy. The show Words and Pictures, which usually airs from 11:30 to noon, is preempted this week while host S.W. Conser turns himself in to authorities at the Fulton County Jail. Words and Pictures returns to its regular time slot on Thursday, September 14th, and, if he's released on bail, with its regular host. You're listening to Jonesy on KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Ken Jones. No relation, by the way. Melinda Peterson passed away earlier this month. She was an immensely gifted actress on stage, screen, and radio, and a kind and generous human being. I met Melinda only twice in person when she accompanied her husband, Phil Proctor, of the legendary comedy troupe The Firesign Theater, to on-air appearances at KBOO. And she made everyone at the station feel like we were among her oldest, dearest friends. I've had the privilege of interviewing Melinda's husband, Phil, several times over the years. In fact, going back to my high school days in Los Angeles, when the Firesign Theater had a weekly radio show on KPFK. Phil, like Melinda, is also a wonderful human being, especially in light of his superhuman talent. And my heart goes out to him and his family during this time of loss and grief. To honor Melinda's memory, I'd like to re-air an episode we did for one of my previous KBOO shows, The Holy Crowley Hour, which ran monthly on Monday nights at 11. The date? October 22nd, 2018, and the occasion, the 80th anniversary of Orson Welles' famous broadcast of War of the Worlds. Portland's fake radio presented a live onstage performance of the radio play that evening at the Alberta Rose Theater, featuring Phil, also Jonathan Stark, actor, writer, producer, and co-creator of the TV sitcom According to Jim, Sam Mowry, artistic director of Portland's Willamette Radio Workshop and voice actor extraordinaire, and fake radio's artistic director, David Koff. After that night's performance, Phil, Jonathan, Sam, and David dropped by KBOO to guest on my show live in the studio. Melinda was there too, watching us from a corner of the room despite my coaxing to join us on the mics, and as an added treat, David Osman, Phil's fellow Firesign, phoned in from his home on Whidbey Island. It was one of the most memorable moments in my radio life and an incredible joy and delight. I hope you can feel that for yourself when you listen back to the show, and I hope it provides some comfort to those of us mourning Melinda's passing. You're listening to the Holy Crowley Hour on KBOO Community Radio, coming to you live tonight from our studios in Grover's Mill, Oregon.
Is anything ever live?
That little ruckus I told you about before the break, well, it turned out to be a full-blown invasion. Aliens from outer space, you're thinking, perhaps the very same Martians who tried a similar invasion 80 years ago. Ha! This is much, much worse. This time, it's an invasion of thespians from the planet Thespia. In other words, voice actors, albeit some of the very best in the business. Faced with annihilation and the revoking of our FCC license, we've raised the white flag and welcomed them into the KBOO studios. I'd like to introduce Phil Proctor of the legendary Firesign Theater.
Yeah, I'm a legend in my own mind. Thank you very much. Nice to be back at KBOO.
And David Koff, artistic director of Fake Radio.
Hello, Portland. KBOO for Halloween.
Sam Mowry, voice actor extraordinaire for Fake Radio, Tesla City Stories, and the Willamette Radio Workshop.
Bring back the boo ball.
And Jonathan Stark, who has a number of credits. He was appeared in Cheers, Ellen and Bob, wrote for Cheers, The Nanny, The Drew Carey Show, and created the sitcom According to Jim. Is that Jim Belushi?
It is, in fact.
You know, yeah. He was actually at the station earlier today.
No, you're
really?
Kidding.
Yeah, so he must be in town. You guys should
Small
hook
world
up.
Yeah,
unless it was a hologram.
It could have been.
You can tell these days, you know.
So, Jim, you're probably listening to the program, so come on down.
Well,
come on
down.
I'm not even supposed to be here, but they were my ride home, so.
Well, Jonathan, we're glad you're here. Phil, Sam, and David Koff. Oh, and we'd also like to welcome on the phone from a spacecraft somewhere off the coast of Washington State, Phil's fellow Firesign, David Osman. David, are you there on the line?
I am glad to be on KBOO anytime at all, Ken. And what a distinguished a mob.
Yeah.
God,
left-wing mob.
I don't know. It's always hard not to see anybody's face, but I think I remember Phil Proctor from about 52 years ago. And let's see, Sam Mowry. I certainly know you, Sam.
Hello, Sam.
He won the Mark Time Award. Didn't you say
yes,
that?
Yes,
oh,
several.
Nice, yeah, that's right.
And, David and everybody, here I am.
Jonathan.
Hi, Dave.
You can go on. It's been 80 years. That means it's been 30 years since we did our War of the Worlds with you, Phil.
Yeah, no, that was the 50th anniversary, huh? I've lost track of them all. But it was the 50th anniversary, right, Dave?
Right, 50th anniversary. Jason Robards Jr. was the Orson Welles
mm-hmm.
character, and you were many things, as I recall.
I am many things, as I recall.
Introduction.
Yeah, and Steve Allen. Steve Allen was in that show too, right?
Yep.
And tell us some of the other people: Hector Elizondo, and anyway, who else was in it?
Well, Steve was the newscaster that was poisoned as the Martians. He's as they're crossing the Hudson River.
Right, right.
And let's see. Everybody was
Rene Aubergenois.
Rene Aubergenois, of course.
Wow, what a cast!
It was incredible. Yeah. But I thought, David, that you, because you remember things so well, and you write these wonderful books that are based on your diaries, and you've got so many facts and faces in them. I thought you'd remember who was in your show.
Everything. Yeah, you think I remember everything at 11 o'clock at night?
No. Okay. All right. All right. I'll let you off on that.
Well, 20 years ago.
Let me give public radio the plug that it deserves. Scott Simon was the the reporter on the spot.
He was Carl Phillips, the part I played tonight.
Was Carl Phillips, exactly. Yeah.
Wow.
And let's see.
Were there any women in our production? Or?
Yes, I'm Terry Gross. Begins.
Oh, wow. Another public PBS person. Wow.
What Terry, role did
pubic
Terry
radio.
Play?
Yeah, right.
Terry was well known, but not very well known.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, go back to your beginnings in radio. This is a broadcast you're doing from your local community radio station. Just make it up.
Yep.
These are the points you have to hit. And the points were, of course, you know, that they were playing music from 1938 and so forth. But she ad-libbed or wrote her introductory piece, which is then interrupted as mm-hmm. it is. So the take was a satire on public radio, national public radio in particular, as it was in 1988,
uh-huh.
30 years ago. And we did that for two reasons. One, because the original broadcast is sustaining, that is, had no advertiser.
Right.
Advertising.
True.
And because once I got really close to the thing, I realized it was really funny.
Uh-huh.
It's really funny.
Yeah, so you did an adaptation, and it was released as a CD or several CDs?
We released it on, before that, the amazing thing about it, Orson Welles is, a great big comet with a tail, and this 50th anniversary dragged us along with him in doing this show, which was, we'd bought the rights from Howard,
mm-hmm.
Everything was above board.
Good.
And, in the first place, it was an all digital recording.
Right, one
from
of the first.
From the very beginning, it was done with the first DAT machines that were in the country by Randy Tom, and it was done at Skywalker Ranch.
On location.
Mostly exteriors.
Yeah, which is fascinating fun. Now, of course, the reason that we're... who distributed it, Dave?
Well, we did. It was another World Media production.
Oh, okay.
Judith Walcott, my wife, and myself, we were looking for a project to do. It was funded by the National Endowment for the Arts, and then we had to bring in a lot of money afterward to finish it.
Sure.
And it was... we put a time limit on it, which had never before been heard of. We said you had to broadcast it on the 30th or the 31st.
Right.
You had to.
Right.
And public radio resisted that, as you can imagine, dug their feet in. Wouldn't you? Wouldn't any great radio station say, well, you know, Charlie's got his program on. He's here every 2 weeks. Gosh, you know, we can't kick him off.
That's right.
But eventually, we were on 350-odd stations.
Wow. Plus I bet they were all odd.
they were that night. The hardest place to get into was Florida.
Hmm. Okay.
Mm. Yep. You have to be a hurricane, we thought.
Or a gator, I guess. Right?
Yeah, something.
Or a bush.
Right. Or a bush, yes. A bushy boy.
Or a bush. Yeah. But we had huge coverage, and we did release it on CD. And it was, you know, it was what it was when it was.
Yeah.
And we moved on to our next project. But I'm really, what moves me now is this 30 years, you know. I mean, that program was 30 years ago. So.
It's astonishing, isn't it?
Ooh, yeah.
And tonight what we did was, of course, a live audio performance, which is something that I have dedicated my later years to. And
yes, you too.
Yeah. Right, yeah. And Dave and I have also done Firesign pieces in the same kind of format, audio format. But David Koff over here, push the cough button, David. Push the cough
button.
He is presently the steward of Fake Radio, which I've had the great pleasure of working with a couple of times. Well, three or four times.
Yeah, it's been a bunch over the years, for sure.
Yeah, speaking of that, see, Mike, that's
that
a microphone.
Thing?
It's been a bunch of time over the years. You've done at least five or six shows with us at this point.
Yeah, I have.
Yeah.
What was the first one, David? Do you remember?
Zach Hanks put us in touch, and I remember that your first show was with us at Bang, which was on Fairfax in Los Angeles.
Melinda remembers that.
Stage Door. Yeah. I think she's right.
Oh, Stage Door. Yes, right.
We did the Lux Radio Theater's version of Stage Door.
And of course, but Dave, I don't know if you're acquainted with Fake Radio. The trick of Fake Radio is that if you're doing something like that, you know, with Cecil B. DeMille, it's an authentic script, and the first half of the show is usually done with respect for the style of the time, and you know, the kind. And then they usually at a commercial break, it starts to go out into the stratosphere.
Yeah, once the language of the commercial starts to make it clear how absurdly they would speak down to women, all bets are off, and we start having a little bit of playful fun.
Yeah, and then it becomes it has what we used to call in Firesign Theater the rubber band moments, you know, where you can go off on a tangent and have some fun and improvise. And believe me, it's an absolute hoot because he over the years he's assembled such a wonderful repertory company of very multi-talented people who particularly have an antic kind of Firesign Theater surreal mentality, and that's what I think gives it its flavor and its fun.
High praise indeed, sir. Thank you.
Oh, please.
Now, tonight, the first half was actually the improvised and a very funny first half. That was Ray Bradbury's story, Mars is Heaven.
You know that, Dave, right?
Well, yeah, Mars is Heaven is where that was the first play I ever wrote for radio when I was in high school.
You wrote it under the pseudonym of Ray Bradbury?
Not all this time. I thought it was a Ray Bradbury.
Yeah, me too.
Holy crap, I finally met the author.
I met Ray when I was 15, and I listened to radio all the time. So literally, the first radio script I wrote was an adaptation of Mars
is Heaven. And, of course, you became a close friend to Ray Bradbury in the years that followed.
Over the years, and we worked with him on various projects, including The Wizard of Oz. He came in at the end of our big production of The Wizard of Oz and did like 20 minutes on what it meant to him, meant to him, the book. And he was always incredibly sweet. And,
yes, he was. He was a dear man.
And we really loved each other, I think, all of our lives. He was somebody that just meant a a great deal to me.
And of course, David Norman Corwin was a very close friend of his as well, because Corwin gave him his first big break, didn't he, in publishing?
Right. Without Corwin said to Ray, Norman said to Ray, you know, these short stories, they go really well together in a book.
About Mars.
Put them together right. About Mars. Yeah, that was Norman's idea.
The Martian Chronicles.
That was it.
And that was what made
Ray
him famous.
Yes.
Who introduced me to Norman, but Norman was, I read the Odyssey of Runyon Jones, a half hour from the early Corwin, 13 by Corwin series when I was in junior high.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And just the right age to play the character in that heartbreaking show about a boy who goes to heaven to try to find his dog.
That's right.
Just a heartbreaker, not a dry eye in the house. And I always wanted to play that boy. And, it, you know, I don't know, 40 years later, I was the director of it. Because I owed it to Norman to do this, you know?
Yes.
Because he really opened... Ray opened the world of writing to me, but Norman, very specifically radio... dialogue, actually what the Fireside Theater learned how to do, which was to write dialogue on our feet often.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it was the combination of improvisation, especially this radio format is such a wonderful place to be able to do that, to be able to create characters instantly.
Simply by changing your voice in a particular way.
Isn't that right, Dave? You know, and also to be able to bring in material that you write and throw it out at the other people that you're working with. And we were very lucky because we were a self-producing unit. Now, I know, Jonathan Stark, you have worked with the Suits all the time. You've worked in network stuff and cable stuff and all of that. So you've probably approached your work a little differently, even with your own sensibilities and contributions. Talk a little about that.
I think I'm lost. No, I don't know. You know, I mean, when you have a script, when you're working on network, you know, you don't do a lot of improv. I mean, the writers like their words. Ellen was always improvising stuff, and she was brilliant at it. And Jim had some good ones.
Jim Belushi.
And he had some good ones. But you have to be for some reason, she could really always, during the week, you have different scripts. You do different scripts. That's the process.
Yep.
She would, on Friday nights, she'd do a take of the script we had for Friday, but then she'd go back and she'd take things she remembered from the week before. She had a photographic memory.
Wow. Time.
She was wonderful.
Oh, so she could edit in her own head.
Yeah.
And during your tapings, your live tapings, she would play with
tapings.
It?
And some of the actors could have been, could be good at improv,
yeah,
but they weren't good enough, you know?
It's a style, and I know as an actor when I did, sitcoms like All in the Family or whatever, you always came in, especially if you were a guest star, you came in, you know, dedicated to performing and presenting the lines as they were written to support the cast, which was, you know, the reason why the show was a success.
Yeah, and sitcoms, you don't really have the time to sit down and go, okay, now let's do a couple of takes and just make it up.
There's a story that Rob Reiner tells about that, where he was working for Desi Arnaz on one of the Lucy shows, the later ones, later manifest. I think it was called the Lucy Show or something. And at the time, because of his success with All in the Family and all of that, he came from an improvisationary background, and he applied that to the work he was doing in this particular sitcom. And Arnaz blew his stack, his Cuban stack, and ranted and raved and said, you know, I paid $10,000 to these writers. You cannot, you know, pretend to make your own words up, you know. And Reiner was almost fired. But he decided, okay, all right, okay, it's okay, because he was kind of known as a bad boy. He was playing bad boy parts, you know, at the time.
Well, I think we've almost all been fired at some point.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. I was replaced by Eric Severide's son once in New York.
He's a comedy genius.
Oh, well, you know that. You probably wrote for him, you know, a couple of times. Eric Severide's son in The Cherry Orchard. off Broadway.
Another great comedy.
Great comedy. Yeah. Well, Chekhov, he started writing vaudeville, you know, Russian vaudeville. And then, because he was a country doctor, and he realized how nuts all these people that he was visiting were because of their isolation and all of their financial problems and everything, and the changing nature of the Russian society and their relationship to the serfs and all of that, he found comedy in that, you know? And he started writing, really, these wonderful kind of heartfelt, heart-rending comedies about the interaction of these people and how the society was changing them and changing it. But he started out writing sketches. I've directed a couple of them in Russian, which was thrilling and fun. Or I should say, я не знаю, как это снять, но это было хорошо, смешно. It was good and funny because he wrote really well. He wrote really funny. I'm with the Antias Company in Los Angeles, as is my wife over there on the floor, Melinda Peterson. She started earlier than I did. She started on the floor of Antias before we built it up. And Antias was affiliated with the Mark Taper Forum and the Center Theater Group. It was a prestigious company. Mm-hmm. And it was basically a company that decided they wanted to double cast things and they wanted to investigate the classics in new ways with a really talented group of actors and actresses. And one point in our career, we did a series of an evening of Chekhov, I think it was called. We did a whole bunch of his vaudeville sketches. And they're wonderful.
Were they funny, actually?
Yes, they were very funny. Right, honey? Yes,
oh,
she said
we
yes.
Have Melinda here in the corner.
Yes. Silence gives me
my wife, Melinda Peterson.
We should get her in front of a mic.
Oh. She's too tired.
I'm too tired to be on mic.
She's too tired.
It's been a long day.
I want to say, too, that I write a lot, but I was started out as an actor. I did a movie called Fright Night, 1984. Fright Night, which is everybody writes around this time of year.
Yeah.
But I did a play with Phil about almost 2 years ago. Yeah. Dan Castellaneta wrote it. And we did it. Gail Mathias was in it. We had the best time. And Phil and I each played probably 10 different characters.
Yes, that's right.
And
so much fun.
It was just the best people. And we were at the Gary Marshall Theater, and it was so much fun.
Yeah, when it was still the Falcon, Gary had not passed on to the next realm. It's now called the Gary Marshall Theater. It's a wonderful. I've worked there twice now over the years, and it's a very comfortable, fun theater. Now, Sam, you're doing.
I was just going to ask.
You're doing radio stuff in a theater too, right?
Yes, yes, yes. We've been doing it since 2001, the Willamette Radio Workshop, and this Halloween we have a production of Macbeth coming up. It's 1 hour long because my wife decided that is the original ghost story. It's got ghosts, it's got witches, it's got bloodshed, it's got murder. It's perfect for the kids.
And that's Cindy McKean is
yes,
Sam's
Cindy
wife,
McKean.
A very talented, what would you call it, a radio playwriter?
Yes.
Radio theater.
Just a writer. She's been published in other things as well, but she's been very helpful to me to have a partner who writes so well for radio. And we spend a lot of time listening to Firesign Theater and Otherworld Media's works when she was getting started, because I've always been a radio fan, but she kind of came into it later, and we just, I kind of took her through everything that I loved, and this is what I love about radio, and she really got it really fast in terms of how to create a world that people can inhabit just through sound, and we actually did a Writers on the Air workshop for like 3 or 4 years running, and we finally just we got a RAC grant to do it and everything. We just got kind of tired of spending every summer getting 10 to 12 writers together and introducing them to radio. But we've had so many people asking for it, we might be picking that up again because there's such a resurgence of audio drama on these days with
all the
audiobooks
and all
podcasts
that
and let's face it, people, podcasts are radio. It's radio on demand. That's what a podcast is. Sorry, I'm an old grump that way.
I think it's revived radio theater because I talk to a lot of young people. They don't own actual radios anymore. Right. Maybe in their car, that's about the only place. They have Bluetooth in their phone.
Right. They don't have iPods anymore either, and that's what it came from, is podcasting. That's true.
Right.
So, I thought it came from whales getting together and singing.
No.
No, I don't know. What do I know? I actually have a podcast on the air now, which is my book, Where's My Fortune Cookie?
Oh, I wanted to get to that. Okay. And also David's books, too.
And David's books, too. And David, have you done any podcasting with your stuff?
No, you know, the only podcasts I've done have been, you know, technological. I get invited to these places where suddenly a new technological device that I don't understand is demonstrated, and I go away even more discouraged than before. No, I am learning to use a smartphone. I've spent a day finding and using the on-off button. So I got to start.
Good. That's a smart thing to do, Dave.
If I can just get it on and off quickly and successfully. It's not like picking up a phone, you know.
No, it isn't.
No, I love what you said about there is really another renaissance. How many have we seen? 4 or 5 in our lifetimes?
Yes.
In our professional lifetimes?
Yes.
Renaissance of radio drama. Which, of course, and you're absolutely right, Sam, podcasts are just nothing but radio. Radio on demand, that's great. We could have had that years ago, years and years ago. Judith, my wife, designed a whole radio on demand, all spoken arts, 7 day a week. An amazing thing, which this was in 92, and back in 1992, where you could have with 6 channels, did this down in the Stanford area on a TV station. So it ran in on a one of the TV channels, and you could listen to radio drama, comedy. The George Tirebiter had his own show. It was a brilliant idea, and it was just too early technologically.
Yeah, well, but that's so much true of our whole career.
You know, I had a question for David and Phil. When you talked about the different revivals of radio theater, you talked about radio drama, but comedy, the Firesign Theater, I think, were transcendent. You call it a comedy album. I've got like about 10 copies here that Phil was signing. But to me, it's literature. I mean, it's like Shakespeare. It's not Cheech and Chong. It's not even the Credibility Gap. I was wondering if you thought anybody was doing something similar today at that level of quality.
Well, Dave and I have talked about this over the years, and fairly recently, when the Firesign Theater was our archives were acquired by the Library of Congress for $500,000. So David and I took that money and we rented a library and we sat down and we read every book in that library and trying to see if where the roots of our inspirations came from.
You know? What'd you decide?
Not at all.
No decision.
No roots at all.
Of consequence, no.
Rootlessly.
But what the Firesign Theater did, and nobody else has done, was to create a long-form comedy album. And we were influenced greatly by the Goon shows and by other surrealistic English comedians.
Bob and Ray for the US.
Very much so for me, Bob and Ray, and Ernie Kovacs visually, of course. David and Phil and Peter, we all had certain influences in common. But the fact that we, I think of it at Halloween in like a bunch of witches sitting around a cauldron, you know, as Peter throws in an eye of newt, David throws in a chicken foot, you know, and I throw up into it, and Austin, you know, dives in and drinks it. And no, but then we would kind of mix it all together. Uh-huh. And what we came up with was this new kind of format of comedy, which had a lot of levels of comedy to it, a lot of multiple puns and things. Sometimes, and I'm sure, David, this has happened to you too, we listen to our old material, which at the time was new material, and find new understandings and new meanings in it because time has moved on. And certain things that we thought were funny at the time have become true you know, our comedy was always very predictive and very surreal and very avant-garde, and that's why it holds up so well. And if anybody wants to hear our stuff or buy our books or all that, you can go to firesigntheater.com, and we're actually redesigning the website right now. My darling daughter, Kristen,
who used to live in Portland, right, Phil?
Who lived in Lake Oswego for a couple of years. With my beautiful grandkids and her wonderful husband, Jeff. She's redesigning and modernizing our website. But the stuff that's there, you know, is still as pertinent today, which is why we want to upgrade as it was then.
You're listening to Jonesy on KBOO Community Radio. Today's show is a rebroadcast of an episode we did back in October 2018, commemorating the 80th anniversary of Orson Welles' famous radio production of War of the Worlds. Our in-studio guests that night were Phil Proctor of the Firesign Theater, fake radio artistic director David Koff, Willamette Radio Workshop artistic director Sam Mowry, actor, writer-producer Jonathan Stark, and, joining in by phone, Phil's fellow Firesign David Osman. We're dedicating the show to Phil's wife, Melinda Peterson, who passed away earlier this month.
Let me just join in on the thank you for the it's really literature. I believe it's really literature too. And there are, you know, there are really three legacies that the Firesign Theater has. The audio archive is one of those, and it's vast if you include radio.
Right.
It's hundreds of hours of produced theater, of produced audio comedy in the studio, maybe 30 hours, something like that.
Yeah.
Maybe less than that. That's one archive. Another is live performances, which we have been doing, which we started doing the minute Electrician came out. We were on stage.
Yeah, so we develop our material on stage.
Always worked live, and the big live performances were the precursors of the albums in many cases.
Yeah, one of the albums that I'm holding in my hand now was Radio Now Live, which we recorded here in Portland.
Half of that album I think is from Portland. The introduction is from Portland, and it's very sweet. As I recall,
we developed our material at the Ash Grove in Los Angeles.
I remember that.
Yeah, which is now the Improv, has been the Improv forever, and Ed Pearl's the Ash Grove. Ed's still around writing stuff and producing stuff, and that was our opportunity to try the material out in front of a live audience before we put it down on a record in the studio. And that was a great advantage.
And you did a lot of touring, even after...
Well, when we became well-known, I think it was a Don't Crush That Dwarf Hammy, the Pliers album, Dave, that kind of kicked us off. We toured around the country together, and we did some major tours, and we did some, you know, more modest college tours.
Did you do when you do it in front of an audience, did you end up doing a lot of rewriting, or did it work pretty well, or how did that work?
Go ahead, Dave.
Burst in there. Because, you know, there was such a span. The first tour we actually took was in 1970, and we were doing things really based on our radio shows,
yes.
not on the albums.
He's saying that it was the radio shows, not the albums so much the first time.
Yeah, the really big tour was 1974. That would mark the peak of our then popularity. And that was when we played Carnegie Hall.
Right, we played Carnegie Hall, that's right.
This was a two-act, memorized, costumed show that...
With special effects.
from the first four albums, yes.
Yes.
From the first four albums.
The quadrology.
And you guys did not... deviate from the scripts when we did
it would upset our fans. Remember that, Dave? Because they wanted to hear us do our favorite hits.
They wanted to hear the bits
as they were, and when we would improvise within that context, it would upset them a little bit, you know. It's like, wait, that's not the way. It's like Dylan, you know, he's going electric. No, that's not the way. So we did have to compromise to a certain extent in terms of that. In the later years, when we wanted to simplify what we were doing and still perform, we would have scripts in hand. And that was much more like our radio shows. It was original material, contemporary material, especially Peter Bergman. Peter and David worked together on Radio Free Oz, different manifestations of Radio Free Oz, which is where it all started.
So pre-fire sign days.
Yeah, on KPFK back in the
also 90.7, as it turns out.
90.7?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
You were asking about podcasting, and that was the last work that Peter and I did together was Radio Free Oz as a podcast.
That's right.
When he was up here on the island in 2010.
The island nine. Being Whidbey Island. For
Whidbey,
those
Whidbey Island.
I was going to say, that's impressive. You have your own island.
Some people do, man.
True enough.
Yeah, and a plane to get there with, too.
Yeah.
But Peter lived here. He felt like he really became a native because he had survived two winters here. Not just one winter, but two. And
the summers are very clammy up there, aren't
they? It's totally gorgeous in here for in the summertime. But anyway, Peter was a neighbor. We just put our whole relationship back together again.
Yep.
Peter was really a very
Yes, exactly. That's Bergman all over.
Peter was in two places at once.
Yes, he was in two places at once when he wasn't anywhere at all.
Yeah, very often. And so sometimes he was the world's best friend that you had, and at other times he was so occupied by what he was doing in another world, literally, that you couldn't get his attention. But he had a great year and a half here, and we did a show every day. And then when that was just too much, I would come in and do it, I guess, weekly then when he moved down to Los Angeles. And then we'd set it up in the studio here. Always brilliant. I miss the fact that Peter was really, really brilliant.
He was.
And an extraordinary way of looking at life.
Yeah, he was a comedy machine. And he ultimately just did it himself into a computer. He did his own Radio Free Oz podcast on pretty much a daily basis. I'm so sorry we lost him 5 years ago now, because I just can't imagine what fun he would be having with the world that we're living in now,
right?
You know, which could use a lot of humor right now, you know.
Think about it all the time. Precious Phil Austin, who has been gone now for 2 years.
Yes, right.
And that's Nick Danger and
so many wonderful characters.
So many voices. And at the end, when he created Bebop Logo.
Bebop Logo. I'm looking at a picture of him right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
What
there
a
he
great,
is.
Right sweet now. Character that is.
And he was also such an amazingly surrealistic writer. He wrote he wrote some pieces that we would perform as a four-man unit that he had written originally just as, you know, a single piece, if you will. And they killed. They were just wonderful. He was an amazing writer. And I guess the other thing is that David has written a lot of things on his own. I've written my book, Where's My Fortune Cookie, available at Amazon.com, which is a memoir more than a book of comedy writing. But, you know, I've had a funny life. And the fact is that all of us, one way or another, Phil wrote a lot of independent stuff and books and stuff. Now, David, what's the latest thing that you're coming out with and that we're coming out with?
We are coming out with two big books. I have just right in front of me is a draft of We're Doomed.
We're Doomed.
Which is the 21st century trilogy, Give Me Immortality or Give Me Death, Boom Dot Bust, and Bride of Firesign. So all of those scripts and a lot of material that's related to them.
Yeah.
From Fools in Space, from the radio show, the scripts with Hal and Ray and so forth, are included in that. And that kind of wraps up the recorded literature.
That's right.
You really have it's everything from the Columbia albums basically is in Marching to Shibboleth, the big
book of plays. Book of plays. Right.
And then the early stage pieces are in Profiles in Barbecue Sauce.
That's right.
Early radio pieces are in Exorcism in Your Daily Life. And anything you want to is not only the whole, every
a Shakespearean parody.
Of Shakespearean parody that we ever did.
But profusely and footnoted.
Profusely footnoted.
It's a riot, that book.
All Shakespearean comedy should be.
Yes, absolutely.
That was actually Peter's last writing were those footnotes. The last comedy writing he did were some of these extraordinary footnotes.
A great parody of academia, and minutia and all that.
And then, of course, we
released a book called A Duke of Madness Motors, which is our radio years told from each one of our perspectives. And it includes a MP3 of 85 hours of our radio shows from various, because that's where we worked out. I mean, the gift of radio. I'm sitting here now, in the gift of radio, talking about the great gift of radio and the audio world and the heads of the people that we're talking to right now and invading, because they've chosen to listen to it. That was the thing about our records. Our records were uncensored because they weren't going to be, we didn't write them to be played on the radio or exploited on television or anything. We wrote them for people to take to their home and play in the privacy of their own lives. And it wasn't until the FM revolution happened that we suddenly found our work being played in college campuses all over the place. And that's why we really had this tremendous success that we did, which is still very unrecognized. Our success. Firesign Theater, four-man satirical comedy group, Monty Python of America, started in the 60s. 55 years we did all this stuff.
Oh, you just reminded me to wish the Monty Python a happy birthday. It's their 50th.
That's right. 50 years of Python. Yeah, and they're still going strong in their own way.
We preceded everybody. Everybody.
But we inspired people to. We inspired certain comedy
for you. Inspired me.
Our material, the Smothers Brothers.
Jonathan, did we inspire you?
No,
I was so stoned most of the time.
He was too stoned. He was too stoned to be inspired.
But that's John's shortcoming. I took being stoned and I added your albums to it, and the two together was like peanut butter and jelly of comedy. It was fantastic. I was living in New York City. I'd graduated college. And some friends said, you should really check this album out. And I said, what is it? And they said, it's the Firesign Theater. And I said, that's great. Who's that? Trust me, go home, smoke a bowl, put on your headphones, and just listen. And I did, and it blew me away because it was...
Yeah, what was that first one, David?
The first one that I heard was Don't Touch That Dwarf.
Don't Crush the Dwarf, Hammer the Pliers.
It was psychedelic. Yeah. It was character driven. Yeah. It was funny. It was strange. It was bizarre. It was very well produced in terms of its audio quality.
Yes.
There was sound coming in and out of both channels. So the experience of hearing it for the first time was overwhelming because I realized here were people that were doing comedy in this tripped out way. That was funny, and you were parodying various things that were going on.
And somehow
you combined comment on society, comment on politics, psychedelia, and it blew me away.
And multiple references and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
Now, the reason we were able to do that was, and it's in my book, Where's My Fortune Cookie, is that a fellow named John McClure fought for us after our first album came out. And it sold whatever it sold because who knew who we were? We didn't know who we were.
And that was Waiting for the Electrician.
Waiting for the Electrician or someone like him. And he went in and fought for us at Columbia Records. He said, these guys are, going to really go places, and I'm going to sign them to a spoken arts contract. Now, what did that mean? scene.
Everybody knows that's where the real money is.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah.
But that's where the real art was, because we were given unlimited studio time to do our work. We didn't have to pay for studio time.
Wow.
And that's why we're poor now. But no, that's why we were able to create these very complicated
models. That's literally why we're poor now, Phil, because we traded that for mechanicals.
We did. We traded it for royalties. Okay, but
yeah, mechanicals, which you get
plays
for every record that's pressed, not for every
record. Oh, everyone's pressed.
Well, what's a mechanical, David?
A mechanical is you get the artist gets a fee for every album that's pressed or for every song. You know, it's a mechanical payment. That's why they call it
automatic in a way.
And we did give that up and. The thing was that we were, as far as Columbia Records knew, we were a rock band.
Yep, we were treated like a rock band.
We were contracted what else did they know? Like a rock band. We were advertised the only rock band that doesn't need music.
That's
they
right.
advertised us with those words when we had an album full of music.
Yes, yes.
I might add.
Yes.
You know, because we always had music in all of our work. It was an important part of what we did. I mean. Phil could play the violin,
and Austin could play the guitar, and we wrote music together.
You know? An Irish tenor and a country boy Phil from Fresno.
Yeah, right. He embraced rock and roll too. Austin wrote a wonderful album called "Roller Maidens from Outer Space," which is kind of an amalgam of country and rock, And all of us turned our attention to the musical elements. The most musical album, Dave, which you might have been referring to, is Fighting Clowns, right? Well, with artwork by the great, late Phil Hartman.
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
And that was an entirely musical presentation with little skits woven into it that we did at the Roxy.
That's the centerpiece of my memoir, which is Fighting Clowns of Hollywood, which covers that period of time that we did three huge Roxy shows and just about everything else. So the book is a combination of a lot of stuff is drawn from my journals because I always kept pretty detailed journals when we were in the studio or writing.
Yeah,
I always like that. The movie of the making of the movie. You know, the writing.
Yes,
the making
right.
of the thing.
Right.
And so there are a lot of scripts from those shows that are part of that memoir. It was like the middle period. Peter always called it Fire Sign 2, which was this period between 1979 and 1981, and we did. Everything. We did radio, we did Nick Danger over and over and over
again.
Yep,
lots of stage work.
What were the CDs there, or the albums? Was that in the Next World You're on Your Own around that period?
Next World was 75.
Oh. Yeah. That was also a time when Procter & Bergman were out on the road, and Dave and Phil wanted to really do more studio work. So, and they were kind enough to invite us in to that project so that, we always tried to embrace all of us and use all of us in anything that we would.
But you had your own CDs too. I got one right here, TV or Not TV.
TV or Not TV
also,
was the first
I should
one.
Mention, David, that when I first moved back to Portland, you and Phil Austin were touring and playing, I think, Portland State University. It must have been late 75, early 76.
It would have been probably late 75. That was our first little road tour, Dr. Firesign's Theater of Mystery. It's remarkable. It was kind of like a singer-songwriter evening. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He played the guitar. I read poetry. It was, and we did comedy based on those characters from the high-low desert area, which we were fascinated by. Being Californians, which the two of us were, and Phil and Peter.
We were more Midwest and East Coast.
And that was kind of everything you know is wrong territory, yeah, and hotter than heater and hell mouth.
I can't remember the hooker. Right. Something in Hooker, right?
Right.
Those movies, because we made a movie of Everything You Know Is Wrong, and we also did a Martian Space Party. We did a couple of short films and things. They are available on Everything You Know Is Wrong, Declassified Firesign Theater, at our website, firesigntheater.com. It's a two DVD set of our stuff. And we, because of our wonderful archivist, Taylor Jessen, we have been collecting material that we did in the past and reformatting it and digitizing it and reinventing it and getting it out to our fan base, and then anybody else who discovers it and wants to enjoy the crazy zany humor that we created.
Well, I want to encourage people to go out and buy this stuff.
Buy the stuff.
I was going to ask how.
If you don't buy the books that you and Dave are writing, that how is Dave going to be able to buy his own island? Yeah. Now, we are all going to need to chip in and do the right thing.
You're right.
Whitby's not going to come cheap.
No. Get the boat to the island first.
No, I think his book will be called No Man Has an Island.
No Man Has My Island.
Look, here's the thing. There is such the We're Doomed book. That's not the end. There's a book of short stories of Phil Austin's.
Yep.
There is a book of our two major motion pictures, which were never produced.
Yep. The Odyssey.
The Odyssey. And
Saucer.
Yeah. I've never heard of those.
Well, there you go.
There you are. You will.
You will. They're okay. Coming.
And the scripts for The Big Suitcase of 1969.
I've heard of that.
Yeah.
And you did Zachariah.
All the other things we did.
Well, Zachariah we actually wrote on. We wrote Zachariah. But it wasn't the movie that we wanted to make.
No, that script, though, the 56 pages that we wrote
script.
Before they said, that's going to be in the book, too, the real Zachariah story.
Yeah, and we were writing for CGI when we were writing movies. The Odyssey is filled with extraordinary special effects, and the same thing with Zachariah. He was going to have slowed down bullets and all kinds of very psychedelic, approaches. We wanted to put modern characters in the Old West, and it was misinterpreted because Joe Masseau, who had originally initiated the project and was working with us, and he was going to direct it with Bob Dylan, right, as in the lead role, he dropped out at a certain point. He just couldn't take Hollywood. And so the producer, Dave, what's his name? The producer?
George England.
George England. George England, who had directed Shoes of the Fisherman, among other things. He was totally the wrong person for that project. He didn't understand that project. He had us writing and rewriting the scene where Zachariah leaves his home and, has a confrontation with his father and leaves his home. We never made it in the movie, of course, but we spent, days toiling over this idea. Yeah, Jonathan is nodding his head. His old gray head wisely. He's been through this a lot more than we have, I'm sure. But anyway, the movie was what it was. And because England didn't understand, I love you, man. He didn't understand that. It has become a homoerotic cult film. The relationship between the two protagonists, Zachariah and whatever the other kid's name was, Don Johnson.
Map.
And John Rubenstein. What was his name?
Matthew.
Yeah, John Rubenstein and Don Johnson. It is an interesting movie to look at from that perspective, and it does have its moments where you can see a glimmer of what we were trying to do. But George made it all surreal instead of making it the Wild West with all these modern interpretations, like the Sisters Brothers, which is out
there
now. Oh,
that just came out. Actually, the writer of that, of the novel, lives in Portland, Patrick DeWitt.
Does he? That's a wonderful movie that reinvents the Western sensibility because it applies contemporary thought to, you know, to the world that they had to survive in at the time.
No, unfortunately, we have to wrap it up. This has gone so fast, and it's been such an absolute thrill for me to be.
Well, you have to wrap it up at Christmas time.
Yes, but,
you know, not the horror.
Halloween.
The horror of it is.
I just want to say one thing, that you guys are the best audio actors in the world, and thank you for that. I always tell people when I'm directing something, it's taking the words off the page, and you guys are incredibly funny and smart and great writers and all that. But every time I would listen to your albums, I was a teenager, it was like it was just happening right there. It's like I had some way that I was listening into this alternative world, and it fascinated me, and I wore out grooves in the records trying to catch the ends of something as somebody was walking off stage, and it's because it was so real, and you guys are amazing that way, and thank you David, and
thank you so much.
You know, I remember listening
to
the album.
Thank you.
I don't remember the words. I was just too stoned.
You were too stoned.
I was laughing.
It was funny. Yeah, it was funny, and you didn't really have to understand it to get the humor out of it. You know, because we took you someplace.
Well, I better thank you all: Phil Proctor, David Osman, David Koff, Sam Mowry, Jonathan Stark, and Melinda. There in the corner, Melinda Peterson.
Waving at us.
Thanks very much for coming in.
Now gets to go home and go to bed.
We got Joe Woods coming on next, so let me wrap it up. You're listening to the Holy Crowley Hour on KBOO in Portland, the radio station that welcomes sentient beings from pretty much any planet. A big thank you to our guests tonight, Phil Proctor and David Osman of the Firesign Theater, David Koff, Artistic Director of Fake Radio, Orson Welles' younger and smarter brother, Sam Mowry, and Jonathan Stark, amazing writer. And and your improv was just amazing tonight.
And listen, if you want to see the show that we did tonight.
I'm actually going to mention that.
Good.
Yeah, so you can still. The show tonight was superb. It was at the Alberta Rose tomorrow night.
It was, and we've got a recording of it. So folks can both buy tickets at our website, fakeradio.net. For our shows tomorrow and Wednesday in Hillsborough. They can also, within a week, come to the website and hear the very show that we did tonight on our website.
Great.
Other archive shows?
That's great.
We've got a lot of other shows that are archived, but if people are tuning in to hear Phil, John, I want them to know they can hear him on our website. But yes, we've got a lot of shows archived.
And is it a subscription or is it free?
It is 100% free.
That's
because
great.
I am not committed to having to buy my own island.
Okay.
Well, I've got to wrap it up. I'm getting kind of that finger across the throat from Liam in the air room. So that's all for this episode of the Holy Crowley Hour. If there's even the slightest possibility you liked what you heard tonight, you can tune in every fourth Monday of the month from 11 p.m. to midnight. And you can stream and download previous episodes, including tonight's, from our Holy Crowley Hour page on the KBOO website at kboo.fm. Many thanks to Crowley Cult member and Holy Crowley Hour producer Jason Harder, to Liam Delta for engineering tonight's show. I'm your host, Ken Jones, saying see you all again next month, Monday, November 26th at 11 p.m. In the meantime, I'll be heading outside the KBOO studios to catch a ride back to Carl Crowley headquarters in Beaverton, where the Martian invasion is already in progress. Good night, everyone. Joe Woods coming up next with Faraway Places, formerly known as Gas Music from Jupiter.
Good night. Thank you.
KBOO, Portland.